your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Good morning, you beautiful bunch of fuckers, and welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. It is Tuesday, January 23rd. We are here live. It is time for the Power Hour. We'll take all of your maintenance-related calls. Those phone lines are open right now, so start dialing 319-527-6791. Or hit the dial now button on your app. That will get you in here. We can talk about everything and anything, maintenance, engines, performance, fuel mileage, modifications, upgrades, troubleshooting, emissions, electronics, you name it, we'll tackle it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and join us. I see Bruce is here, so we'll bring Bruce in and wait for the rest of the team. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. As always, it's our pleasure to be here.
What's on your mind today?
Well, on January 4th, 1984, a young man came to see me. Keep in mind, this was our sixth year of being in business. And he applied for employment, and I hired him. He was right out of Rosedale Technical School. And I, at the time, did the fuel pumps and the injectors, and he was kind of fascinated by the pump stand, and his name was Pat Sharp. Now, this is Pete Sharp's twin brother.
Pete, our
vice president, who does the show with us. This is Pat. They're not identical twins, but they're twins. I don't even know which one's older, but it doesn't matter. So since 1984, this is his 40th year with us, 40 years of building Big Cam Cummins pumps, injectors, turbochargers, oil coolers, after coolers, MVT, mechanical variable timing units, and water pumps. I'm trying to think of all the other components. Virtually oil pumps. Every component, accessory drives, every component on the Big Cam engine we used to build, and he has built them.
Wow.
Okay, they're in. So they're Leroy just let me know that they're in on the show, Shelby. Anyway, okay. We want to say congratulations to Pat for giving us 40 wonderful years, and most people never see him because he's in the pump room, and he comes in the side door and out the side door and eats his lunch in the pump room and keeps it absolutely spotless. Well, you've been in the pump room and you've seen how he keeps that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. Bruce, somebody being at a job for 40 years is so rare these days. But it always tells me something about a company when, and it's not just one employee that you've had for a long time. Pete's been there a very long time. You have a lot of people that have worked there a very long time. I was just down at NASDAQ, and same thing. And I always notice that because it's really unusual today. People jump jobs all the time now. And to see long careers with one company is pretty rare, but it tells you something. And I'm always impressed by companies that have a lot of employees that have been around a long time.
Well, Pete started in August of 1987, so he followed his twin brother. And Amy, our secretary controller, she is around 35 years now. And Brian Moan, the shop foreman, he's in his high 30 years. And Sean Mangle, our parts manager, who is Amy's nephew. We do hire families here. One time we had Adam that does the Hawkeye Report. We had two of his sons working here one day, and one company stole the one son away, and the other son ended up getting back into the motorcycle racing He was a dirt track racer, and then he's had a chance to go with a company that sold products at the races. So,
okay.
Anyway, so I just wanted to say that about. Oh, I want to say some people tell me through Messenger that they like the old stories. So I want to say a story about Pat Sharp. Mechanical variable timing units, MVTs. That's what we use to change the timing on the big cams. It came from the factory on the twin turbo 475 in 1985, 86, 87. And very few people knew much about them, but Pat knew a lot. And we had bought every, when Cummins left Los Angeles and went to Juarez, Mexico, they had 54 MVT units, and they shipped them all to us. And so Pat had rebuilt all 54 of those, plus he had done several hundred up to that point. But we had a truck in, and I think it came from Minnesota or North Dakota, one of those northern states. And Cummins had built the engine, the Cummins distributor, and there was a problem with the MVT. So we took it off, and we repaired it and put it back on, had the truck running great. And a couple weeks later, I get a phone call from our Cummins distributor, which was a mile down the street from us in Harmer, from a Bill McKee, who was the general manager there, and he was a personal friend of mine. And he said, Bruce, I got a complaint from the Cummins distributor in Minnesota, North Dakota, whatever. Said that MVT unit that you guys built, you put the rack and pinion in backwards. So it's a rack and pinion that moves the cam followers in and out to change the timing. So I said, boy, that's amazing, because Pat has rebuilt so many of those. So I go into the pump room, and I said, Pat, we've got a complaint from Cummins that you put the MVT shaft in upside down. He looks at me, he said, it's impossible. I said, why is that? He says, because on a rack and pinion, you know, you have the teeth cut into it, and on the one end, there's no teeth for about a quarter inch. Well, you can't have the pinion go where there's no teeth, right? It has to stay on the shaft with the teeth. So he hands me the rack and pinion, hands me the center section of the MVT unit. He said, here, try it. And I wasn't able to do it. So I load that into my pickup truck. I go a mile down the street. I walk in. Because if you say we did something wrong, I want to verify it.
Right.
So I take it in. I put it on Bill's desk. I said, I want you to put this together backwards, upside down, whatever they said we did. And he fiddled with it for about 3 or 4 minutes. He said, it's impossible. I said, that's right. Now get on the phone with that guy that filed that complaint to you and tell him you have these parts in your desk and you have Bruce Mallinson right here at your desk. He called the guy, and he explained to him that it's impossible, you can't do it. And so then I said, now I want a letter of apology addressed to Pat. And we got that letter of apology.
Good.
So
good.
That was one of my short stories for things that happened in the past.
All right.
So last week we talked about Shauna Gray. What's that?
Oh, go ahead.
We talked about Shauna Gray out in Brandon, South Dakota, one of our dealers, and she does the MV alignments and the remote tunes and the catalyst dealers. And she's a dealer for this stuff called bull snot. Not that familiar with it, but she's making me familiar with it because she sent me some of this hand cream to put on where I had the icing on my face where I froze my face, but that's all new skin now. So she sent me some spray-on wax that I'm going to try this afternoon and some window cleaner that she said is great for shower stalls. And Anybody that has a ceramic shire stall with the grout in the middle knows how hard that is to keep that clean. But she sent me two bottles of hot sauce. Now, I'm going to read what's on the label. I would never, ever say anything like this on your radio show. But the fact that we're not on XM, I think I can do it this. But this is right on the label.
Okay.
Trucker G. G-Spot Hot Sauce. Puts exotic heat to your meat. Mango habanero and garlic habanero. How about that for on a label?
There you go.
I thought that
was a little racy.
Little dicey there.
Yeah.
Also wanted to mention, Pat Sharp's been working our pump stand for, we bought it in 1981 or 82. He's been working it since 1984. He knows the pump machine so well that if it fails, he takes it apart. We usually can either make the part or we have our friend John Anderson make the part and we put it back together because the company's no longer in business. But it was the early 90s. I had my 89 Dodge Cummins pickup. We were looking for a new injector machine. It's made by Hartridge that runs the injectors for the big cans and small cans and the K-Series Cummins. And these things were really expensive, several hundred thousand dollars. So I was looking for a used one. And I got a phone call. And it was late in the afternoon. And the people that had it were in Oklahoma. They were in the eastern part of Oklahoma. And they said, if you want it, you better get here fast because it won't last. I immediately went home, packed an overnight bag, and I was on my way to Oklahoma, and I was there the next morning and bought this Hartridge HA290 injector comparator machine. And it was a similar message that I got when I found my Kenworth in Kansas City, my single axle with the 840 CPL big cam with the VIT interior, the one that you borrowed from me.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the same thing. I called the place in Kansas City. They said, we had five of them. We're down to one. If you want it, you better give us money right now and get out here to get it. The next day, I was in Kansas City. So there's a saying, snooze, you lose. If you want something and you have the money for it and the opportunity comes, you got to go after it.
Hey, Bruce.
Opportunities don't last.
You know, the other day when I was running around trying to take care of the two properties and the coach and it was snowing and freezing, and you said, boy, it seems like you've added an awful lot of work. And we have. It's been a lot of work because we were not in the market for that property, but that was the dream property that at some point we were going to go out and look for. And the 12 years we've been living here in Oregon, we've bought a couple properties. We go look at properties all the time. But we were picking up, you know, just vacant land that we could turn into vacation rentals, put a tiny home or a yurt or something, because it's just a big thing here in the Gorge. And ultimately, we were going to look for some sort of a property like that, but we weren't really in the market yet. But the statement you just said, opportunity, when you find something, you've got the money, you've got to take it. And, you know, there's always that saying, well, there will be another property, there'll be another house, another investment, whatever. And sometimes, most of the time, that's true. Every once in a while, it's not. And I had a realtor tell me he'd been selling real estate in the Gorge for 40 years. He said, this is a one-of-a-kind property. He said, if you didn't get this, he said, you may never have an opportunity to get one like this again. He said, you could probably buy some raw land, but by the time you turned it into what this is, and if it had all the same amenities, and he said, you would pay way more than what you just paid for this property. And it was horrible timing for us. I mean, it was, and it still is in a lot of ways. But it was just one of those things that I just had that gut feeling that I should not pass this one up.
What you were looking for was a little farm. And how many little farms are there? Now, if you're looking for a fixer-up house that's on a half-acre lot or a quarter acre lot,
they're everywhere.
It's a different thing. But when you were looking for something like what you were, just like that truck we talked about last week that was found, a new A-model Kenworth with, 16,000 miles on it?
Right.
1676, but it was ultra-low mileage. I mean, when you find something like that, there is no time to think about it. You have
right.
to react and go.
So you know how we have cliches and sayings that there's one, you know, you just talked about, you just have to take advantage of it. And it just was one of those cases. It was kind of a one-of-a-kind thing. The odds of finding it again are almost zero. And sometimes you've just got to make that decision. Now, I was going to say that the cliches, there's one that kind of sums up what you just said. He who hesitates is lost. And that's really what that means, that there are times where you just have to be decisive. But then there's another saying that is a cliche that says, look before you leap. Which one am I supposed to follow?
But the look part, you've already been looking.
Yeah,
you had
you're
been
right.
Looking,
and that was
thinking
the case.
About that farm, right? So you
yeah.
had been looking. So it's just don't leap all of a sudden. There's something there. If you know what you want. Years ago in the sales training I was at, they said if you want something bad enough, take a picture of it and hang it on your bathroom mirror. That
yeah.
way you see it every morning. And I did that. I put a house in Colorado up in the Rocky Mountains on my bathroom mirror. And it took 27 years later to finally get it, but I got it.
That's
and,
right.
And so,
all right.
There was another one.
Years ago,
a guy would stop by the booth in Louisville Truck Show, which is coming up. And I understand you may have a mini CMC there. Is that correct?
I am going to make an announcement right after we hear from Pete and Leroy.
Okay, good. Well, a guy who said 3 years ago you talked to me about the manifold and the turbo and the damper and balancer and the mufflers, and he said, I'm ready to make a decision. I said, it only took you 3 years? Do you realize how much, first of all, how much enjoyment you didn't get out of driving your truck or you lost and the fuel mileage that you lost. And it's the same thing now with the max mileage catalyst. There's still people on the edge. They're still thinking, but they're still spending their $8,000 to $9,000 a year maintaining their emission systems when they could spend $1,500 a year, run the truck on the max mileage catalyst, not have a day's downtime and not have any emission problems, but they're still thinking about it.
I know. So, all right, let's hear from Pete and Leroy. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing great. What is Leroy around? Is he snoozing?
He is. Yeah, he's awake still.
Good.
I'm just
good morning, Leroy.
Where does this fall asleep thing come from? That's what I'm just curious
about. I don't know. We got to pick on you for something. That seems like the easy one.
Yeah, I'm just curious because it's, I don't know. It's very strange. I don't know if Pete
yeah.
has pictures while I'm sleeping on the show.
Not
or what.
Far off though, Kevin.
I see the eyes once in a while.
It's like a toddler needs a little nap.
Yeah.
There you go. Sometimes naps are good. I have to say that there are times that I nap as well.
Oh, yeah. I like my naps.
Yeah.
No doubt. I got a couple
isn't
things.
That why there's a bunk? Isn't that why there's a bunk on a semi-truck?
That's right.
A nap? If you're going down a highway and it's 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and you take that second nod, isn't that telling you get in the next rest area or parking lot and just park it and climb in the bunk for a little bit? Might be 20 minutes, might be 2 hours, might be 6 hours. But the body
sometimes
is...
Sometimes those are my best naps ever.
They sure are.
Yeah. So, Pete, what's on your mind today?
So, a couple of things. So, the shop's fairly open. So, if someone needs to make an appointment, we can get them in pretty quickly. We're also running a diesel force special. It's $22.49 for the diesel force, oil and filters, everything included. And we haven't run specials on that before simply because the shop's been so full we can't get people in. Now that we have some room, we want to run a special on the diesel force, and it's just beneficial to so many people to have their engines cleaned out because they haven't been running the catalyst, that maybe idle a lot, get some sort of failure, and the engine needs clean. So we're running a diesel force special this month, so you can check it out on the website. Had an interesting call. We have a customer that his broker won't let him drive his truck because it was deleted. So he wants an estimate for us to put everything back on. So we do that. We don't do it a lot for whatever reason. I mean, it's not that we turn it down. It's just it's expensive, especially when people had someone do it and they didn't know what was done. You know, things are off, things are missing. It can add up. But if you can't run your truck because you don't have the emission system on it, it's still cheaper than a truck, than buying a truck. And, of course, you can't really sell that one with everything deleted or you won't get much for it. So you might as well put everything back on it and make it legal.
What was the estimate?
So this one, so he needed an estimate for the bank. He said everything was taken off. And usually when that happens, a guy will go down that road when they have a turbo problem, EGR problem, there's an issue. So some of the components are probably bad. But assuming, it needs the DPF, the EGR valve, the VT turbo, the manifold, because all that was missing, DOC, sensors, harness, we're in $25,000 to $27,000 mark for that. A lot of expensive components.
Yeah, it is. Boy. I don't even know where to go with this one. I've got some serious thoughts here, and none of them are good. What's the story? Did he tell you the story on why and how this truck was deleted? Did he buy it not knowing it? Did he delete it? Did he tell you that part?
Well, he must have done it because he has some of the parts. And Eric said, hey, bring whatever you have. We'll reuse what we can. And, of course, if we're able to reuse something, then we obviously take the new part off the bill, and that would bring the price down. So the fact that he has the parts tells me he must have done it himself.
So here's my thought on all this. He spent money to delete this in the beginning, which we have been saying for well over a decade now. Do not delete these vehicles under no circumstances. Don't delete them. It just doesn't make sense anymore. So that was a bad decision that cost a lot of money. And now he's going to double or triple down on bad decisions, and it's only going to get worse. I can almost predict, I hate to do this, but I'm pretty accurate at this. I can almost predict with close to 100% certainty he's not going to be in business next year. He's because I heard you mention the bank. So I'm assuming he can't afford to pay for this. He's got to borrow money now to do this.
Right.
Now, here's what I would say, and I hate to say this because it's not that I care about the EPA all that much or their rules, but deleting these things is a mistake. We've been saying it for a long time. It should be made right, but I honestly think that him spending $27,000 to make this right now and he's got to go borrow the money to do it is a huge mistake. First off, I have never heard of a broker who would care about this issue at all. That I've never even heard of a broker that would even understand this issue for the most part. And I'm shocked that that the broker's that involved in this guy's business that he knows his truck is deleted. And I would have to look at that broker and say, sorry, there's other freight somewhere else that I don't have to spend $27,000 to haul. This guy doesn't have that great a freight, I can guarantee it. Everybody's got about the same freight. And I can't understand why at this point you would now borrow money, pay $27,000 to fix it because one broker says you can't haul my freight. This is a horrible decision.
I'm wondering if they run to California and that's why maybe they're worried about losing their load. If it goes to California, he gets stopped or, you know, issue with the load. I don't know the details.
I would say at this point, where we are in the market, the economy, screw California. There's 47 other states you can pull freight in. I do not understand somebody. Look, if it was a matter of, well, I've got the cash, I'm just going to fix it because I want it to be right. I don't know what you were thinking when you decided to delete it, but it's worse than that. He doesn't have the cash. He's got to go borrow it. And in today's economy, with the market and everything the way it is, these are just really giant red flags that this guy's not going to make it.
So how about this, Pete? If a guy buys a truck, $389, it's deleted, why doesn't he, and so he has zero parts and he wants to put it back on, why doesn't he go around to these shops that are doing the deletes and picking up these parts? Because they're just scrapping them. They're just throwing them in a dumpster. Accumulate the parts. Get a list of everything that he needs and start to accumulate them so that we can put it back on.
Yeah,
Bruce, now that is a really good idea, but I'll tell you what the problem is going to be. I have a feeling this broker is putting pressure on him that he's not going to dispatch him, he's not going to get afraid, he's got to get this fixed, and accumulating the parts could take a while. But I think that's a great idea if he says, look, I know I made a mistake, I want to make this right. To take your time and pick up the parts wherever you can. And again, I am just shocked by this relationship with a broker that, like I said, that the broker is this deep into the guy's business that even knows this. And here's the other thing. I have never, in all the reading from the EPA, the industry news, I have never, ever once even seen a hint that they would hold a broker responsible for something like this. You know, there have been cases where they've held a broker responsible for an accident that a carrier has. And it was a big, big deal. C.H. Robinson actually got sued, and they were held responsible for an accident because they chose the carrier and they didn't do enough background work to make sure the carrier was safe. Now, that was it's rare, but when it happened, it shocked the whole industry, and brokers said, look, you know, we're going to be responsible for these carriers. We have to choose them better. I get that. Not once have I ever seen anything that anybody is going to hold a freight broker responsible for a deleted truck. This whole story just sounds odd to me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Now we can only go by what we hear on the telephone, Kevin. So.
Oh, absolutely, Bruce. I know how these stories go.
He does have a lot of parts, so that we won't know until he brings them here and know what we can reuse and can't reuse.
Yeah. Now I will say this: if he were leased to a carrier, then I could absolutely see a carrier come out with a policy that we will not lease or dispatch deleted trucks. It would be much more likely that somebody might hold a carrier responsible for a deleted truck. Although I've never seen that anywhere either, that would at least make a little more sense, that because in essence, the carrier, when they lease on that truck, they're taking some responsibility and control for that truck. They have the liability insurance, but I've never even seen that be an issue. I don't know. There might be some carriers out there that have that policy. I've never heard of it. But I am shocked that you use the word his broker is making him do this.
I have a word of advice for people that are running their deleted trucks, especially the 389s, because it's easy to know it's a 389. Just look at the headlights. But 2 days ago, I was sitting at a traffic light, and to my right was two Peterbilts, and the lead truck was that black on down the stacks. So immediately, I saw the stacks. I looked at the headlights. I said, oh, that's a deleted truck. I said to Debbie, there's a deleted truck. Just watch when he pulls out. You'll see the black smoke. And it didn't roar black smoke, but there was smoke. And she said, how can you tell it's deleted? I said, well, look at the stacks. Just look at the black 12, 14 inches down the back side. If you're going to run a 389 and it's deleted, have a stepladder and keep your stacks clean, and whoever did the delete, have them set the ECM so you don't roar black smoke. It's a dead giveaway. And these young kids with the diesel pickups that are doing the deletes that are roaring black smoke, and you know, there was a group there, they thought it was really cool to smoke out anybody in a Prius.
For Prius.
Right.
And that has created problems.
Yeah.
So the public sees all this stuff. And if I was a policeman and I was against deleted trucks, that's the first thing I would look at was be the stacks, the year of the truck, and then you know. And I'm not promoting policemen all and do that, you know. These are our customers, but be careful.
That's for sure. Pete, what else you got?
A truck starting out from a traffic light is a billboard. Everybody sees it.
So, one other thing, two other things. One, FedEx and UPS had weather delays. So if you're waiting for a package, it's going to be delayed. There's been just so much bad weather across the country, and they don't refund money for weather delays. So even if you paid for overnight freight and the weather's bad and it didn't get there, it's not getting paid. We've had just lately, every day, guys calling, like, I didn't get my package. It's delayed. It's stuck here. It's stuck there. So just be patient. It'll get there. And
I've got an issue right now. I'm not sure how to deal with it. I've got to go figure it out. I'm not worried about the shipping charges on this. I'm worried about the fact that when it gets here, it's not going to be any good, and I don't know how I'm going to deal with it. I just put in a large meat order from a new farm that we want to work with. We may even start selling their meat in our store. And that shipment of meat is now stuck in the system somewhere. Well, that stuff, I mean, you have to have it shipped overnight. Sometimes you can get away with second day in the wintertime. They put enough dry ice in it. But 2 days is max. And now this box of meat is lost in the system somewhere. And when it gets here and it's thawed, I'm going to have to figure out who's paying for this.
Yeah, that's a lot different than shipping a gallon of catalyst. It can sit in place for a week. But, yeah, you got some food stuff. That would definitely be a problem. You know,
I have a ton of stuff coming in right now. I had just ordered a bunch of stuff, and it all got stuck in this weather delay. I don't even care about the overnight charges. It'll get here. I'll get it. That's fine. But this box of meat is kind of a big deal. It was a pretty big order.
How far was it coming, Kevin, from where?
Colorado.
Coming from Colorado.
Yeah. So we will see what's going to happen. And then, of course, we've got to, once it finally gets here, who's doing what, then I got to reorder it and wait for it to come back in again. So we'll see.
And the last thing I got, I was doing some reading on Cummins' website and on DEF fluid. There is a shelf life to it, which we know we can see bad def in tanks and stuff, but they broke it down as 18 months in the container, sealed under 77 degrees.
And how are we supposed to know that?
Well, right. So, and every 9 degrees over 77, so it's in a shed and it's 90 outside, it takes 6 months off the shelf life.
Oh, that's a lot.
It is. And then also in the truck. So once you have it in your tank, in your vehicle, it's only good for 6 months. Now, there are conditions, I'm sure, like Bruce's Dodge stays in the garage in Colorado, and it's constant temperature, it's out of the sun, a little bit longer. But, you know, it's something I don't think you want to buy a lot of to store down the road, because it does have a shelf life. So be careful.
Hey,
you know, I know it's
you expensive. Just thought of, I'm gonna ask my shop about this. Where I see this being a huge problem is the RV world.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I was just thinking about the only vehicle we own that uses DEF is the Sprinter. But Lisa actually uses that during the summertime as like her everyday vehicle. And the only time she really doesn't use it is when it's been really cold like this, because I would have to winterize it, and then we'd have to de-winterize it, and instead we just park it inside, and we just don't take it out in, you know, in the extreme cold, so I don't have to worry about winterizing it. But she uses it enough that I just kind of went through the math. It probably wouldn't be a problem, but boy, I could see where a lot of people would, you know, the thing's been parked for 6 months, and all they do is drive it from, you know, Michigan down to Florida, or Florida back up to Michigan. And then it sits again, and you have to believe that some of that DEF could get really old in the vehicle.
Well, I can tell you the DEF that was in my 2016 Ram, and I just drove it to right after Christmas. I drove it to Ogden, Utah, and back. It was well over 2 years old because I bought it when Trump was president. And it worked okay. It worked perfect. In fact, the truck hardly used. I used the tank holds about 3 gallon. I used maybe a gallon and a half to go out there and back. And so,
well, here's another good question then. What are the consequences of using DEF that's gone bad? What does it do to the vehicle? Do we know?
Leroy, do you have any thoughts on that? You're the DEF guy.
What's that, Pete? It'll throw code for bad DEF quality,
I would assume.
Oh.
Yeah. I wonder.
Oh, there's actually a code for that. Okay. But, so will it derate then after time?
Yeah, if it can't convert NOx properly, it will derate.
Okay.
Huh. I wonder if it has something to do with the water parts of the you know, DEF is like 30% urea and then the rest of it's like water. I wonder if it has something to do with the water being evaporated off, and then that 32.5% mixture rate that it's supposed to be gets thrown off. It's, you know, the mixture becomes more 50% urea because the water evaporated.
I have a story about this and a question for you guys and even for the audience. So this is somebody we all know well. He has a small fleet of tow trucks. Hino diesel tow trucks. I don't know a lot about those engines, but I don't think it matters. It's a pretty generic issue. So they hire a new tow truck driver. Guy works for a couple weeks, a month. I don't know the timeline on this. He has some issues, so they let him go. Right after they let him go, they have one of their trucks has all kinds of weird issues. They tear the engine apart and find out that somebody put DEF in the radiator. They can smell it in all the coolant as they're taking this thing apart, and that stuff is horribly corrosive. So the engine needs a new head. They rebuild the whole thing, put it all back together. In the meantime, though, they just, this particular driver had driven three different tow trucks during his time there. They checked them. All of them had DEF in the radiator. Only the first one had to be rebuilt. It seems like they caught the other two in time. So now we're months away from that, and the first truck that had the problem that they had to put a new head on now has a blown head gasket again. So they go in to tear it apart, and now everything that water or the coolant comes in contact with inside that engine looks like it's been painted white.
Like some corrosion on it.
So I had that phone call, Kevin. That's why the water passages were white.
Why? Corrosion? Is that what it is?
No, he called me and he said, man, it looks like somebody spray painted the water passages white.
I know. I've never heard of that or seen that. I was wondering if anybody else did and what's causing it. So I got the same phone call, Bruce. It was David Counts from Fleet Air Filter. And he told me I could talk about this and share it on the air. But yeah, so you heard the same things. He says they actually look like you spray painted them white. It's that uniform and solid of a coating, whatever it is.
What would possess an employee to put death in somebody's radiator? I never ever, thoughts like that never would have entered my mind.
I don't think it was intentional. I really don't. And I will tell you, I have opened up the hood on some vehicles with DEF, and it's not that they don't mark them well. They do, but I've seen those fillers awful close to a lot of other fill. You know, I've seen one in one little corner where you've got the windshield washer fluid bottle, and you can't really tell that that's what it is. It's just got a fill opening there. You've got the radiator cap right there, and then they put the DEF cap right there, all three in the same spot. And I could just
what
see
kind of
somebody.
What was that?
What's that?
What kind of vehicle was that?
Actually, the Sprinter is not far off from that. And there's not, think about a Sprinter, when you open the hood, there's not much room there. You know, it's almost like a cab over. The engine sets so far back in. The hood opening, there's not much space. So all those fill and checks, everything's kind of crammed together on a lot of those vehicles.
So like on the Rams, the DEF goes in right beside the fuel. But it's not like that. I would just assume all vehicles would have the DEF be back by the fuel tank. But like,
so on the Sprinter, the fuel tank's in an odd place. You open the driver door, and then you open a little door inside the driver door to get to the fuel fill, which it always, it just feels awkward to me when you pull up to the pump, you're all crowded right there by the door. You've got to open one door, open the other door. If it's bad weather, then you want to close the driver door, so then you got to reopen it to close the fuel door again. That, to me, seems like a horrible setup, but that's how the Sprinters are. But the DEF is under the hood. And like I said, there's not a lot of room there. And you open it up, and there are several things. You check the oil from there. You can fill. You got the coolant. You got the DEF. You got the washer fluid. And I could see somebody not very familiar with vehicles and in a hurry or not paying attention. I could see how it could be done.
Wow. Hey, can I ask you a Sprinter question? It's sure. Not DEF related. Being
yeah.
You've owned two of them, the Sprinters are converted by an RV company. Is that correct?
Right.
And whose conversion do you prefer?
Hands down, not even close, Pleasure Way out of Canada. Saskatchewan or Saskatoon.
Pleasure Way.
Maybe Saskatoon. Pleasure Way.
All right. So what about one done by Integra? A friend of mine
talking about it.
He's a retired doctor. And it's four-wheel drive. I didn't know they made a four-wheel drive.
They do make a four-wheel drive. And, Bruce, you may be shocked, maybe not. But if you – Pleasure Way makes a four-wheel drive conversion, a really nice one. Pleasure Way's conversion are really high quality. They make a four-wheel drive. That the base price on that's like $230,000.
Well, this one's used for $90,000 with 6,500 miles on it.
And how much is he going to use it?
Well, you know, he's a retired doctor, so he took his first trip to Colorado from Maryland. He bought a used Ford Explorer. And he said, wow. I told him several places to see along I-70, but he left a day late, so he didn't have time but he said he really enjoyed the drive out and back. And so now he's thinking he needs to do more of this and enjoy the highway more. But this, this is a Tippin.
Oh, different story now. Not an Integra. So a Tippin, we have looked at them, and they are pretty darn close to the quality of the Pleasureway. Tippin is what I would consider a top-line conversion on a Sprinter. I didn't even know Integra did one, but I'm familiar with Integra, and that would be more of a mid-level. And then you get down to the, like, Winnebago is going to be your entry-level. And they're still expensive. I mean, you're still going to pay, you know, well over $100,000. You're probably going to pay $130,000 to $150,000 even for a Winnebago these days. And you're going to get up $170,000, $180,000 on the mid-level, and they're getting close to $200,000 on the higher-level builds. But Tippin builds a really nice Sprinter.
Okay, it's called a Tippin C-A-H-A-B-A 4x4 19SC.
Yeah, that is a very high-quality conversion. I would not be afraid of that one at all. And that sounds like a pretty darn good price. What year was it?
22. Was reduced from $129.99 to $99, so it's $31,000 off.
That's an incredible price, actually. They must be getting hammered. I haven't watched them because we're obviously not in the market for one. We're really happy with ours. For a while, they were so hot. I mean, I think it's possible we sold our first one for more than we even paid for it. I forget now.
So this has two couches in the back where the bed would be. So this apparently the couches fold down and make the bed?
Correct. Yeah, there's several ours has a bench seat in the very back that is really like a scissor couch or bed. It just flattens out and becomes the bed. And then if you want to ride in it, you can turn it into a bench seat. But I'll tell you this, if I were really, I think the way should go to a higher bed that is just a permanent bed and create more storage underneath instead of the scissor bed, because I will tell you there is no way I will ride in the back on that bench. It is a horrible ride. The Sprinters are a fantastic ride up in the front seats, but that bench seat is so far behind that back axle that the movement is horribly amplified, and it's just not comfortable to ride back there at all.
So you wouldn't sleep there while Lisa's driving?
Oh, no. No way. No, the ride back there behind that axle is not good at all.
All right, so these two seats run parallel with the van, so you can walk and go out the back door.
That's kind of a nice setup. The other setup, like I said, I've seen where they build the bed up much higher and create a bunch of storage underneath.
Okay. I hope our listening public doesn't mind us going off the subject of semi-trucks every now and then.
We're sticking with vehicles. It's all relative.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Leroy, we haven't heard from you this morning other than you're awake. What do you got?
Well, I had one thing about the DEF tank where Pete was saying that it gets too warm, right? I remember when I had that Volkswagen Passat, the DEF tank was in the trunk. And it was a black car. Wow. I think it was cooking. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess if you didn't use that frequently, it would go bad quick. That thing got probably like 3,000 miles per gallon DEF because it got like 50, 60 miles per gallon. And then 2 or 3% of that thing's using 2 to 3,000 miles per gallon DEF. So I think in the entire time I've owned that car, which wasn't that long, maybe 2 or 3 years, I only put DEF in it a handful of times. So it probably was just like they're just cooking. Also,
yeah,
the DEF probably wasn't cooking because Volkswagen.
This whole age of DEF may be a lot like other things we talk about. You know, this transmission can only handle 1,400 foot-pounds of torque, and we put 2,000 through it, and it does just fine. You know, I have a feeling it's another one of those limits that you could probably break that limit pretty regularly and nothing goes wrong.
Yeah. What I will take away from this conversation is don't go out and buy extra death for your pickup trucks or your motor homes and store it in your garage for several years because you got a good price on it. Just don't do that. On semi-trucks, we don't have that issue because
right.
they're buying it every several days. But don't buy it in the 2.5-gallon plastic jugs and store it at home for vehicles. I would do that. I would buy two boxes at a time. So I was buying 5-gallon at a time. So now I'll just buy 2.5 at a time.
Yeah, well, here's something I'm going to change. For me, it just seemed like a good idea. It's easy when you've got death in a jug and you keep it in the garage to just keep topping off the death. I mean, it's not that big of a deal. It's just right there. Grab a jug, I'll top it off. I'll never have to think about death or, you know what the level is. But, you know, we do let it sit quite a bit in the winter. I don't think I'm going to keep topping it off. I think I'm going to let it get down to half or quarter or below before I put new in.
Yeah, I let it get below a quarter. That way I can put the 2.5-gallon in the Dodge. So
I think that's what I'm going to start doing, just letting it get down lower and not just keep topping it off all the time because then you've got old stuff sitting in there more.
Right. So we did learn something from this.
That's right. That was a worthwhile conversation. All right. Anything else, Leroy?
Well, I just wanted to continue just a little bit more on that same topic.
Sure.
I did get a text from one of our remote tuners, and he said he had this question for a supplier, and they told him the same thing as what my conjecture was it's a water evaporation issue, and then the urea becomes over-concentrated. So my response to that would be, I think it's worthwhile if this is an issue where you let death sit around, I would buy a refractometer. I mean, I think you can get them on Amazon. And then just test the depth in your jug before you put it in. So if you have an RV or something, you don't a vehicle that uses depth that you don't put in a lot, just test the depth before you put it in. That's
okay, Leroy. What's a refractometer?
I don't know exactly how it works besides the fact that it probably has sort of refraction thing. But basically, what it is it kind of looks like a small telescope. You put a drop of liquid on it, and then there's a mirror that goes up to it, and then you look at it through the light. And I'm guessing it measures how light refracts through that liquid. And when you look up into the light with it, there'll be like a line around like 32%. That means the def is good. So if you put your drop of def on there, you looked up at the light, and then you saw the line is at 50%, then you know that def is bad before you even put it in.
So, how much is this refract? Say it again and say it slower.
Refract.
Pronounce it right. Say it again.
Refractometer. I can look it up on.
Refractometer.
Yeah, you're saying it correct.
And how much are they? How much do they cost?
I just pulled up on Amazon. $19, $18, $18, $20. So they're like $20.
Hey, Bruce.
Yes.
One, you may be familiar with this. When we did the Evans coolant conversions, we would use a refractometer at the end because you try to get all the water out of there.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we use in our shop for checking depth quality when we're having, SCR issues. That's what the troubleshooting tells you to use as well. They say use a refractometer to test depth quality. It's the simplest, most inexpensive way to check depth quality. And especially if you're sitting in your shelf, I mean, just put a drop on there before you put in your tank.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I may grab one. I know I had one around when I used to do the Evans conversions when we were doing that, but I have no idea where it might be.
So we learned something else today.
Well, I'm about to go back to a topic that I called completely wrong and correct this. I'm a little shocked by this, but this is important that this is coming out. We've been telling people for a long time, don't delete these trucks. I'm going to go back to that because Joel just sent me a message. I said I could see maybe a carrier doing this, but I haven't heard much of that. I'm shocked that a brokerage would do it, but I guess it's a pretty regular thing. Joel works a lot with Schneider through their brokerage, and he says they have to certify that they are emissions CARB compliant to get top shelf loads. Doesn't say just to work with them, but to get their better loads, which is why we talk about building relationships with these brokers. So you get the freight that never gets posted anyway. That's the whole point of doing that. He's actually saying that a lot of 3PLs, which are basically brokerages, ask their, his brother runs their trucking company, to do on-site audits to be considered top-tier carriers. So it sounds like brokerages aren't really enforcing it across the board, but they are saying if you want to work with us as a closer partner and get our best rate, you're, we're going to check to make sure you're compliant.
It's interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, I did not know that was going on.
So, you know, we're worried about it. Well, you know, the government's worried about the what pollutes, and they're making changes. And if we got these deleted trucks off the road, we wouldn't have to go as far with the next set of emissions. But I was also on Common Site and read where the when the X15s came out, they were allowed 4 grams per horsepower hour to pollute. That was acceptable. The 2027 set of emissions, it has to be down to 0.03 grams per horsepower hour of NOx. So they're trying to reduce it that much.
That's we better get Dr. Jane Gates to make the catalyst stronger, huh?
Going to have to.
Instead of burning 70% of the soot, we better burn 95% of the soot and carbon.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Do we have anything else? Calls are starting to pile up. Oh, I have the announcer. If we've got everything else done, we'll talk about the announcer.
I'm done.
Now, Leroy had something else about a DD-15.
Oh, I mean, I kind of took up my slot with talking about the DEF thing, but, I mean, we got a DD-15 in the shop that has the famous issue where it goes through NOx sensors like crazy. We just kind of started the diagnostics this morning. Haven't quite found anything yet, but, yeah, we're in the process.
We miles are on it.
You know, I don't even remember.
I think we lost Kevin.
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. All right. All of a sudden, everything got clearer and louder. All right. So, okay, go ahead.
Like I said, I don't have much to report on yet, but I'm hoping that we come up with some sort of solution because I get that call a lot where people with DD series engines go through NOx sensors like crazy. Like, well, they'll put like 6 in within a year. So I'm hoping I can sort of pinpoint some sort of issue. I finally got one in front of me, so maybe we'll find a solution to this.
So Leroy, is an X15 or an ISX Cummins NOx sensor similar to the DD-15?
Yeah, they're basically the same sensor, yep.
Can we put the Cummins in the Detroit?
I don't think that you can because NOx sensors are smart devices. So what I mean by smart device is that they communicate with the ECM with data transfer. When you have an analog sensor, that just essentially means that it communicates to the ECM with just the voltage change. So you would see maybe the voltage swing from 1 volt to 3 volts. Where if you have a smart sensor, it communicates with just data packets. So it'll send messages like my NOx sensor is not up to temp yet, or it might say my NOx reading is at this, or I need to go into warm-up mode, or I'm having an internal failure. So smart sensors have a lot more going on and they're programmed that way, and the ECM is programmed to talk to it. So it's sort of like a language. So you can't put a French speaker inside of a, you know, a Mandarin country and expect them to communicate back and forth. And that would be something similar what would happen if you were to put a common sensor inside of a DD series.
Okay. So it's not a part that you could make.
You could probably make one. I mean, man made them. Another one can make it, the same thing, but I don't know if it's quite
feasible.
Worth it. Yeah.
On a vehicle, on a car, when you start them and they have to run there at 1,500 RPMs for 35, 40 seconds, is that to warm up the sensors?
Say that one more time, or you kind of broke up on us for some reason.
Whenever I start the Audis, they run at 1,500 RPM. Even if the engine's warm and let's say it's been sitting for a half hour, but there's still 4 bars of temperature, it's 85 degrees outside, it'll still sit there and run at 1,500 RPM for 30, 40 seconds. Is that to warm up the sensors?
It could be. It could be to warm up the catalytic converter. I'm not real sure. I don't play a lot with gas engines, but my guess would be it has something to do with warming the cats up.
Okay. All right.
And that truck
right.
has 75,000 miles on it, the one box, which potentially could need a one box to get mileage. Obviously, we want to do diagnostics to make sure, because it's such an expensive repair, we need to make sure it needs one before we put one on.
The easiest thing to do is just replace absolutely everything and then just, you know,
and that's
be fine.
What most dealerships do, unfortunately. When you have that code, they just throw everything on it. It's going to fix it because there's nothing they didn't change. One box, wiring harness,
that's,
sensor.
It's like having a misfire and being like, I'm going to replace the drive.
Is that truck running the max mileage catalyst?
I don't know. Eric scheduled him in, so I hadn't spoken to the gentleman.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think today he's going to
run over and ask Eric if that truck's running, if he knows that truck's running the catalyst.
Okay. I can do that.
I think today's just going to be one of those weird days, because before I make my announcement, I just thought about something else I wanted to ask Leroy. It's way, way kind of out there. Leroy?
Nope.
What do you know about EMPs?
What do I know about EMPs?
Yeah.
They're in science fiction novels frequently, and they're cool, and they black out stuff.
Yeah. So, and you realize that we could have kind of a natural EMP through a solar flare from the sun itself, right?
I have heard that, yeah.
There was an event in the late 1800s called the Carrington event, and the only kind of technology we had at the time were telegraphs. So we had telegraph lines, kind of like phone lines, and we had telegraph operators, and they could send messages back and forth with Morse code. And we had this CME, a coronal mass ejection, when a solar flare explodes off the sun with so much energy, if it comes in contact, that happens from the sun a lot, but it just ends up out in space and it's no big deal. If it happens in a way where it's directed and actually hits the Earth, the telegraph operators, the terminals caught on fire, the wires melted, it basically destroyed the system. There was so much energy, and they said that could happen at any time, and it will happen eventually. It's just a matter of time. Or an EMP can be triggered by exploding nuclear weapons up in the atmosphere. And so there are two ways that this could occur. And the problem is when it happens, it wipes out electrical circuits. I mean, just absolutely wipes them out. The prediction is that modern vehicles, anything with any kind of computerized circuitry to make that vehicle run, will not run if we had a solar flare or an EMP.
Right. Makes sense.
So, and this is what I'm wondering. I have found a company that makes a device, and it's an EMP shield, and they claim the only way to test this, the only group that has the ability to test an EMP-like event is the Department of Defense. Obviously it's really tough to test for this because you got to generate incredible amounts of voltage and energy. And so the DOD, I guess, can test for this, harden their vehicles or they're supposed to be. And this device has been tested. With everything you know about electricity and energy and EMPs, does it seem like that you could protect a vehicle with this? And it's not even that complicated of a device. Basically, what it does is it reacts within, was it 1 second? I think the Department of Defense's criteria is it has to react within 10 nanoseconds, and it has to disconnect all the circuitry, and that protects this. It kind of cuts all the circuitry off so the energy can't get to it. And it has to react in a certain amount of time with a certain amount of voltage present. And I guess the criteria for the Department of Defense is it has to happen in under 10 nanoseconds. And this device has been tested. It does it in 1 nanosecond. Does all of this sound like it could be possible?
From the very little that I know about EMPs, I don't think so. Especially if it has to do with, you know, large changing magnetic fields. I don't know. It seems like you could still induce voltages into circuits because everything has a natural capacitance and inductance, especially wiring and stuff like that. So, I mean, you can induce a voltage into a wire that doesn't have anything hooked to it. I mean, that's kind of how motors work. So if you added this big changing electric field that you could induce voltage into a wire that causes a spark or something, I think that's going to happen with or without a shield. But I don't know enough about that kind of stuff to say, but my guess would be no.
Part of what I'm running up against trying to research this is that's the answer I get from some really, really intelligent people, is the answer seems to be we can't be entirely sure about this.
Yeah. I think it just depends on the second.
So how many nanoseconds in a second?
Well, a millisecond is a million, and then a microsecond is more than that, a billion, and then a nano is more than that. So
trillion?
I think quite a trillion?
A nanosecond is more than a billion in 1 second.
I think so.
I'll ask the Google gods.
Wow.
Yeah, 1 trillion.
Yeah, wow. That's crazy.
1 trillion nanoseconds in a second.
Yes.
We don't have to worry about that with big cams.
Well, that's the case. If any vehicle that's simply mechanical would not be affected by this at all. But they're claiming that vehicles with circuitry of any kind would just be disabled.
So when it hits, will it just flash and give you a miss, or will it just stop your vehicle?
So all the stories, if you're in the right position and you happen to be looking up in the sky and it's a nice clear day, there might be a flash present. There won't be a sound. You won't have any other real indication that either. Now, a solar flare, we would have some warning that it's coming, not that we could do much about it. There are some things you could do. We could have up to days of warning. I actually have an app that monitors all the activity on the sun, and when they have these hot spots, they start saying, look, this hot spot's developing. Actually, right now, one of the reasons I've been talking about it again, we are at our highest level of solar activity right now than we've seen in a long, long time. There's all kinds of solar flares popping off all over the sun. They're just not hitting us. Sometimes they do, but they're not that strong. You might have some phone interruptions, you know, bad cell phone signals, things like that. But there's a lot of solar activity right now. If it were a true solar event, we may have 2 or 3 days warning that it could be coming. And then there's a lot of calculations. When's it going to hit? What part of the Earth is? Will it hit? Who's going to be affected? But if it's an EMP with a nuclear weapon, and they exploded, I think it's like 20 miles up, if I remember right, you wouldn't even know it happened. And the vehicles will just stop. Instantly. I mean, they stop and nothing works.
Also, Bill wanted to let everyone know I was off by a little bit, by like 999 billion. One nano is only 1 billion, billionth of a second.
Oh, 1
so
billion. From
I was a little off. I can't
billion,
read
Billion, trillion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Close enough. This is the guy you want working on your stuff.
You're splitting hairs at this point.
Yeah, off by a small margin.
Well, anyway, I'm going to keep researching on that, but it doesn't sound like there's any definitive answers to this one.
Let us know when it's going to happen, Kevin.
You know what's kind of funny to me is, I don't know if this has any, like, actual effect, but people are like, oh, it can't hold your cell phone too close to your brain because it, you know, messes with your brain. But if there's this big of an EMP, like, effect, how does that, like, affect your body? Like, does that, like, fry neurons in your brain or something? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thought, too. My guess would be that it's the closest thing that has happened to humans that we might be able to correlate would be being struck by lightning. It's a huge voltage through your body all at once. And I've kind of studied people who have been struck by lightning. The rest of their life is really odd. They just have weird, odd medical issues and conditions, and it messes up a body to be hit with that much voltage.
Yeah, it probably doesn't end well, yeah.
Well, maybe that's how the zombie apocalypse is going to start. It's going to be the EMP that turns us all into zombies.
I got my tinfoil hat on. I'm liking this.
There you go. All right, well, I'm going to keep working on that. Because I've done a lot of research, and there are a lot of people that claim these devices will work, but then there are a lot of people that say, well, you just can't be sure.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Bruce, here's the scoop on the CMC. So to give you some history on how we came to this point, we did our last CMC in 2018. You guys have always been a huge part of it. The event had gotten so big that 2018 took us almost 6 months to get prepared for it. Actually, some things we were doing almost a year ahead of time. It was a lot of work for us as a company, and it just the cost of putting it on to that big of a group for 5 days got so big that not only was it tying us all up for a long time, we really weren't making a lot of money on it. I mean, when you look at the numbers, you would think 400 people at that price, you must have made a fortune, and we weren't. There's a lot of expense to putting that on. So in 2018, we decided to take a year off, which was 2019, and I was going to spend time rethinking how we should put on this event. And one of the ideas I had to be able to put even more material into the program but not have to be at a physical location for 5 full days, and actually I had more material that I wasn't even using, we started thinking about a hybrid where there was a live event, but then there was a virtual training throughout, so we could cover a lot more material. So I was working on that idea, and then COVID hit, and all the events went away, so we forgot all about the CMC for a couple of years because there was really nothing you could do. I happened to get a call from Toby Young, who the Young family basically owns the Louisville Truck Show. And this is their 52nd year, and Toby is third generation. His grandfather started that show 52 years ago. So Toby called us and said, look, we're going to reinvent the truck show. not necessarily the truck show itself, but their idea was to create more trucking events in Louisville the week of the show. He said, look, everybody from the industry comes here. It's the biggest event of the year, and we should have more going on that week. So he said, we're going to start reaching out to partners and creating more stuff to go on that week. And he said, we would really like you to be the education provider for the owner-operator small fleet world. What kind of a program could you put together, and would you want to? So we thought about it for a while, and I said, maybe this is the way we should bring the CMC back, that we have a live event every year at the truck show, which is an official part of the truck show itself. So we are working directly with Toby Young and Matt's and the whole show to make this an official part of the show. You'll pay and register through the event. It will be prior to the truck show itself. So the truck show starts on Thursday. We will have a full day on Wednesday, an event in the evening on Wednesday, and then we'll have a half a day on Thursday, and then you can walk right into the truck show and still have 3 days on the truck show. We will continue that program with a virtual training online, like a Zoom meeting where I can still present. We can show graphs and charts and pictures, and it's about as close to being in person as we can get. That program is going to go an entire year. The CMC now is much, much bigger as far as content. So the plan we're working on right now, and not all of this is set yet, what is set is we are going to have a live event at Louisville this year. What I'm hoping we can pull off is that the entire program is going to be in place. You will come to Louisville this year for a day and a half of in-person training. We will continue the virtual training for an entire year. I am going to teach everything I've ever learned about running a truck in the last 40 years, everything from buying the truck to building a small fleet. How do you get that first truck as profitable as possible? Then once you've got that, if you want to expand, how do you take that knowledge and buy the second truck and start building a fleet? So it covers everything I've ever learned about this stuff. And then you would come back again next year to Louisville for another day and a half, or the end and the graduation through the program. I've built this program. The best analogy I can come up with is like a franchise. So if you look at a franchise, whether it's a restaurant or carpet cleaning or whatever business might be franchised, they've taken and built a model where it's almost impossible to fail. And that's kind of the point of a franchise, that if you follow their model, you almost can't fail. And when you look at the success rate behind franchised restaurants as compared to truly independent restaurants, it's not even close. The truly independent restaurants fail horribly. I mean, they have a horrible track record. Franchise restaurants have an excellent track record. They almost never fail. Pretty rare. So we're kind of taking that franchise idea, and that's how I've built this whole program. I'm going to show you exactly how to buy a truck, what kind of truck to buy depending on the operation, really detailed, what inspection should be done on that truck. We're putting together all the products and services and companies and partners you need to make this really successful. And by the way, you guys might not be aware of this, but you're a part of this whole program because we're going to recommend your entire model and the way you do things. Like if you want to guarantee you're going to be successful, if you want to do every step you can, you would first off work with you guys before you even buy the truck. You guys can help them find the right specs, do the inspections, maybe immediately, well, not maybe, part of the program is after you buy it, it goes and gets the Hawkeye report, or it gets that before you buy it, if you can work that out. And then we go through the modifications of what could we do to this truck to make it as fuel and maintenance efficient as it can possibly be. We're putting together all the products and services and companies in place. So it's like a franchise for a single truck carrier with their authority. And then the next step will be we'll teach you how to expand that if you decide to. Or we will teach you how to run the most profitable single truck operation you can run. So it's really in-depth. There's a lot of companies involved. It's a big program. And we are kicking it off this year at Louisville one way or another. The whole program may not be in place when we kick it off, but we're pretty close. So that's, and this really, we just got the final piece put into place on this last week. And we just had the meeting yesterday where we decided this is going to happen. We've got another meeting this afternoon. We've got meetings all this week because we're pretty close to the date, so we've got a lot of work to pull this off. It still is the CMC, but now it stands for Certified Master Carrier.
So we need to be there, arrive on Tuesday to do this on Wednesday as opposed to arriving on Wednesday.
Possibly, yes. I'm trying to figure out my whole schedule for that day and a half of training. And some I may want speaking live at the event this year. And some companies will be a part of the program later down the line throughout the virtual training. Just depends, and I'm still working on putting all that material together. So, like, letting you guys know, because if anybody's going to speak, you're probably going to be one of those. And it's just really going to depend on the schedule, and that's what I'll
be
working on.
We need to make our, like, I'll be flying in, but Pete and Bill, they need to come a day early. And Leroy, will you be attending this year?
I believe so.
Okay. So we all need to arrive on Tuesday to be ready to do this on Wednesday, along with setting up our booth.
Yes, very possibly. So, and I'm in the same boat. I'm trying to make, you know, travel arrangements now, but, you know, with an event this big, normally I sometimes fly in late the night before or the morning of when I fly in. I need to get there significantly this year just to make sure I'm there, especially with the way travel's been lately. But it is official. It is happening, and we're pretty excited about it. And this will be CMC 2.0 Certified Master Carrier going forward.
I think it's a great idea. I'm glad you're doing it, and we look forward to being part of it.
We love that. And like I said, there's the CMC, the training itself, but then even bigger than that is this franchise model that we've built, and we want you to be a big part of that. Here's the only difference between this and a true franchise. You know, like I said, the franchise has worked out all these things, your suppliers, your partner companies, everything has worked out for you. The difference is in a true franchise, you don't have any choices. You buy into the franchise, which is expensive to buy the franchise initially, and then those franchise companies pay a fee forever based on their revenue. A percentage of your revenue goes to the franchising company forever, and you don't get to make any choices. But people buy franchises because they succeed. We're making it, I think, even better. We'll put the whole franchise model together. We'll show you exactly what you should do every step of the way, but you get to make all the choices. We don't force you to do any of this stuff. If you want to find some other shop that you think might do this better, you're free to go do that. We're just going to say, look, we've been doing this a long time. We've worked with a lot of companies. We've found the best of the best in every category, and here they are, and here's how you work with them in this program.
That's great news.
All right. So we're excited. It's a lot of work, but I'm really excited about it. It's good to get back to this. And I love the way we've got it set up. And to have a partner as big as, you know, the show management at MATS, and we are now an official part of the MATS program itself, is a pretty big deal. And we've got some other pretty big partners working with this.
And I have a bit of news I forgot to mention.
All right.
I've been dealing with the engineers at Peterbilt about 228 gear ratios and the 12-speed auto shifts. They said, well, we also have the 13-speed and the 18-speed in auto shift. Now, I didn't know that. I didn't know you could buy a new 18-speed Eaton auto shift. And with the PACCAR MX-13 and the X-15 Cummins, you may be able to order a 228 gear ratio in the very near future. We're still working on that.
228, is that going to be matched to a direct drive or a single overdrive?
Single over. Or even a double over. You just won't run it in double over. When I first spoke to the one engineer, he got back, he said, that's 127 mile an hour truck. I said, but we're running in direct. So we're only using the overdrive gears when you're going down long grades or you're empty. Or, you know, when you're coming down off those plateaus in on I-70 in Utah, God, I think sometimes you're going downhill for 30 miles. You can just flick it up a gear or two and just let it roll.
So with your working with the engineers on this so far, have they mentioned what RPM they would be comfortable going down to with that engine?
We're talking to keep it in the 1250 RPM at 65 to 70 miles an hour in direct.
Okay. So not really aggressive downspeeding, which makes sense. No. Yeah, interesting. All right. Boy,
my goal is not to see how low we can get the RPM. It's my goal is to see how little boost we can use to make the truck go 65 and 70.
Got it. All right. We are going to get to some phone calls. Let's get started today in Illinois. Bill, welcome to the program.
How y'all doing today?
Good. What can we help you with?
Well, first off, Leroy, I replaced that DEF dozer thing, and it cleared it all up. There was crystals, and it was a leak. There was a small little leak coming out of that. So I replaced it, did a force regen, works great. But here's a question I want to ask you guys, because this was the first for me. I was in Rochelle this weekend. The highest it got was zero. The lowest it got was negative 10. I did treated the fuel according to how the bottle is, and then I also used the fuel-borne catalyst, awesome product. I went out there at negative 5, started up the truck. She started. You knew the engine was cold. She started fine, but then the engine it would get to normal oil pressure, and once in a blue moon, I'm assuming because it was thick, because it's all full synthetic, it would go from 50 to like 80, real split second, and then it'd go back down, and then it would go back up a little bit, and then it would come back down, and then it leveled off. But how hard
are you talking about oil pressure?
Yes.
Okay, and what engine is this?
X-15. She runs great. You know, go ahead.
Go back a second. You said it was full synthetic?
Full synthetic. Because I'm the same truck that I had brought it up to Pittsburgh Power to get all that work done.
So why do you think the oil was really thick?
Just from the oil pressure. From the oil pressure going from normal to, like, super high and then it back down real quick.
Well, hold on a second. First off, the whole reason why synthetic is so much better in the wintertime is because it doesn't thicken like that. And if you ever want to prove this to yourself, go buy a gallon of traditional oil and a gallon of full synthetic and set them outside when it's that cold, and then go try to pour them out of the bottle. You'll see a huge difference. Now, I heard, did you say 40 to 80 pounds of pressure?
No, operating pressure is like, I would say 35. And then once in a blue moon, because when I first started it up, it go there and then would crank up to like 80 pounds and then would drop back down to normal oil pressure.
That can't be oil. Something else is causing that. The oil can't go from so thick that it's creating 80 pounds of pressure down to normal in seconds.
Well,
could it be
normal?
The pressure regulator?
That's what I'm thinking. If there's something else causing this, not the oil itself.
Yeah. Well, it's working good now. I mean, back into normal normal temperatures, as I call it.
I'm not saying it's not working. I'm not even saying there's anything wrong with it. All I'm saying is you can't correlate that 80 pounds of oil pressure to the oil being thick and then 1 second later it being 40 pounds or 35. It's not thick oil causing that reading of 80. There's something else going on.
What do you think? Anything like a relief valve got stuck or something?
Yeah, I would think it would be in the pressure relief valve. I wouldn't be too concerned about it when it's really cold. So, I mean, you have a clearance issue. What happens if the bore is on the minus and the plunger is on the plus?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, when it's 35, 40 degrees, everything's fine. But when it's 10 below, things do change.
Yeah. Now, does the extreme cold really beat up the engine when it first starts up? Because I know my batteries took a beating this weekend because it was so damn cold. But I'm just curious.
You weren't at a place where
you
could... Were you at home or a place where you could plug it in?
No, I don't have an engine block here. All I had was a tri-pack, an S-bar heater, and that tri-pack is hooked to the radiator to the truck. So, yeah, I mean, she was just running. So.
Okay, well, if your tri-pack's keeping the radiator warm... And the coolant should be circulating through the engine.
Yeah.
So you should be okay.
Okay. Okay. Because I was wondering how much damage or whatnot does a really, really frozen engine at negative 10 would really beat up on an engine trying to start it up. But she's a good truck.
Well,
I let it idle for like an hour, got it up normal temperature, and on the way I went. So,
yeah.
I was always wondering. Areas. That's all.
When we, years ago, there was a video that just appeared on social media. It showed I'd say it was an old Big Cam 400 starting, and it was well below zero. And we'd get them started, and they would run on two or three cylinders, and they would bang and pop, and white smoke pouring out the stack. And you think, wow, that can't be good on that engine. And yes, we want to try to plug them in and keep them warm or have some type of auxiliary heater, but your chances of spinning a rod or main bearing are greater at that point. But we did it for years and didn't have issues. These new electronic engines are amazing how they start when it's cold compared to how the old mechanicals did.
And with the advancement of oils, I mean, the fact that he's running synthetic is going to make a big difference. It's not like he's running 20, 50 mineral base in there at that temperature where, you know, oil is not going to flow. You know, it's
right,
something like that.
Right.
Some bearing issues, but, you know, 1040 synthetic, like you said, it pours pretty thin, whether it's 20 degrees outside or 80 degrees outside. It pours the same pretty much.
You know, years ago, we used to take charcoal and build fires under trucks to get temperature so we could get them started. And that was in Pittsburgh, not North Dakota. So.
Yeah, well, you know, Bruce, I was telling you about that 1972 Ford tractor I've got. And there's a couple things about that thing I'm pretty impressed with on the engine. that it started at about 4 degrees, no starting fluid, started hard. Like you said, that thing, it's only a three-cylinder. When it first starts, sounds like it's running on one, and it's banging and popping. But it started pretty nice with no starting fluid, which I was happy with. The other thing I was a little shocked about, I've been working it pretty hard. I've been plowing the driveway, I've been moving a lot of snow. And the other morning I went to check the oil, and when I pulled the stick out, I panicked because I thought, there's no oil on that stick. And, you know, I'm still getting to know this thing. I don't know how much oil it uses, but I'm checking pretty regularly. And when I first pulled it out, I'm like, there's no oil on the stick. And then I started looking closer, and it was a little dark in the garage, so I got my flashlight out. I couldn't see it because it was still so clean. That was good to see. I know. Pretty impressive.
You know, you'd mentioned ether. And a lot of people don't want to use ether. But there was a father-son team, Frank Bursick and little Frankie Bursick. And Frank had an NTA in a peat, and the son had a small cam 350 that we had making a lot of power. And it was well below zero. And I watched that father and son team start that truck. And one would be outside just giving a little pst, at a time of ether just to sweeten the air.
Yeah.
And to start those trucks, because on that NTA, that small cam 400, the pistons were 13.5 to 1 compression ratio. So super low compression ratio. Pete, was it 13.5 or 13.7? Do you recall?
I thought it was 13.5. 13.5.
13.5? Okay. So, and they would just stand there and just give it a little spit every so often when the engine would want to die. And they never rattled the engine, and the ether worked perfect that way.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Whenever we were working with John, I forget his name, he was from Ohio, on the pulling truck, it was a big cam, and I had Cummins was working with us, and we had it out at the Cummins factory. I think those pistons were machined down to 12-1. Even in the summertime, to get the engine to run, we used almost a whole can of ether.
Wow.
And we had this engine out in front of the engineering center, towed it out on a low boy. I got to drive it out on one of our 800 horsepower big cams in a 359. That was a lot of fun. But we unloaded this. Now, we didn't even get it off the low boy, and a lot of Cummins engineers are out in the parking lot, and John goes to start it, and I'm working the ether, and we used almost a whole can of ether. We smoked out the whole building. And one person ran out, thought the building was on fire, and they were going to call the fire department. We had so much white smoke. And all these Cummins engineers are standing around, smiles on their face. They loved it. And then John was doing burnouts in the parking lot with this thing. And it was at about 1,200 or 1,400 horsepower, big cam. And so it took, in the summertime,
wow,
a full can of ether before the engine would stay running.
That's crazy. You know,
we have pictures of that in our driver. Is that picture still in the driver's lounge?
Look, I haven't been in the driver's lounge for a while. I'll have to check. I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
You know, Bruce, it seems to me like one of my early trucks, and I'm thinking it might have been the GMC Astro with the big cam 350. One of my trucks, and I'm pretty sure it was factory, had an ether injection system.
Yeah, absolutely. It went right into the crossover.
Yeah.
And the little nozzle went right into the crossover. So that's where we a lot of times would hook up a turbo boost gauge because the ether bottle was missing and all the stuff was gone. But if I had to go out and start my new truck and it was well below zero, I wouldn't have a problem giving it just a little snort of ether just to keep from cranking if it happens to want to crank.
Yeah, I don't think
just
it would
a little
be
bit. Just a, you just want to sweeten the air, you know.
Start so much better.
Yeah, I've seen customers in the old shop with the old big cam days come to pick their truck up and set for a couple of days. You know, from those deals, they dropped it off. They had to make their way back. It was cold out, and they would just light the truck up with ether. You know, no finesse at all. It was they would just light it with the airplane or jump in a truck, and it would rock and rattle and just, oh, my God, I'd cringe thinking, oh, this engine's coming apart in our parking lot.
That does sound horrible.
Yeah, I'm surprised how many guys that did that and didn't have the finesse to, you know, just enough to keep it running. That's all you need to do.
Sounds like repeat business to me. I'd be selling it there.
Keep a little bit more.
We've never needed that.
You know,
well,
I'd sell it in a fire extinguisher size.
So something we had that we did years ago, the old big cams and Ks that were high horsepower would run really rough during startup. You have low compression pistons, you have slow timing, you have big injectors. And unlike an electronic engine that will monitor the metering and the timing of the fuel, these engines didn't. And it was just dumping fuel in at the rate it was supposed to. But we put a two-cylinder cutoff on it. So we ran two fuel pump solenoids. And when they were both energized, all six cylinders would fire. So we'd fire the truck up on all six cylinders. And then in the cab was a switch, and we would cut off power to the one solenoid that would cut off fuel to two cylinders, which at that point you'd think the truck would run like garbage, and it would smooth the engine right out. It was amazing. It's hard to wrap your head around it. It's running rough, and you eliminated two of the four cylinders, and it would smooth out.
Well,
which
the reason
work harder to build heat in the other cylinders.
Right.
That's why it works.
See, it takes to idle a big cam or a 14-liter engine, and I'm sure all of them are very similar. It takes 1.3 horsepower to idle. That's not a lot of heat, 1.3 horsepower. And so it's not enough to burn the fuel. So the two-cylinder cutoff made the other four cylinders work a little harder and made a little more horsepower to make a little more heat. God, I forgot about that, Pete. Thanks for bringing that up. I forgot
about
worked that
really
two-cylinder
well.
Cutoff.
I have a trivia question about ether.
Okay.
Does anybody know what old farmers in the Midwest refer to ether as?
No.
Vitamin E.
Oh, yeah? Never heard of that before.
I hadn't either. Matt just shared that with me. He says the old Minnesota farmers call it vitamin E. Yeah, I had a situation just this last week. I was shocked that old mechanical diesel started up without ether. I was just as shocked that my new modern propane generator wouldn't start without ether. I thought propane wasn't as affected by cold as diesel was, but I could not get that thing to fire up. I had to give it a shot of ether to get it going.
So do you keep ether at your place, at your shop?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I've got some in the coach. Not that I've ever had to use it on the coach, but I thought the other day I was going to have to use it on the coach to get the generator going. The engine actually started pretty well. I could not get the generator to fire up, and I was going to get under there and start messing with it, and I let the engine run. I got the aqua hot going and got it circulating, and then I got the generator going. But, yeah, I still have a can at home, a can out at the farm, and one in the coach, just in case.
Yeah. Ether's a good item properly used.
Yeah, it doesn't take much. Oh, Matt's got, I guess I assume the opposite. Matt said propane engines are horrible in cold weather. I experienced that. I thought it was the opposite for some reason. I'm not sure why.
Was your APU on your fifth wheel, Bruce, was it propane as well?
No, gasoline.
Oh, it was gasoline? Okay, I thought it was propane.
Mm-hmm. No. 7.5 kW owning gasoline.
So you didn't have any problems with it starting out west?
No, worked perfect.
All right, we should probably get
a perfect mold generator.
We keep talking to each other. We should probably talk to some callers. Let's go to Oklahoma. Paul, welcome.
Howdy.
What's on your mind today?
DES. So I have a question about it, and then I got a little short story about my neighbor. So DEF will freeze at 12 degrees Fahrenheit. Does that change the composition, or does that make it degrade or anything once it thaws out?
I didn't read. So when I was on Common Sight reading about this, it didn't say anything about cold weather. It was strictly heat that would shorten the life of it.
Okay. So last week, last spring, my neighbor, or last summer, my neighbor bought a new Chevy pickup truck with a diesel. And when I went down there to see him last week, he says, I got a check engine light on my Chevy. I might have told you this, I don't know. And he went to the dealer and said, can you turn the light off? And they turned the light off, and by the time he got back home, it would come back on. And I said, I'll bet your DEF froze. He's like, what? I said, bet your DEF froze. So by the time, a couple of days later, when he went back there, the temperatures had got back up again, and he just went there and he told them to turn the check engine light off. And he said, I know what caused it. And they said, well, what do you think caused it? And he said, the DEF froze. And they said, well, we've never heard of that before. Because it don't normally go to 12 degrees in Oklahoma for sustained periods of time, but they turned it off. And he said it didn't come back on again. So pretty much all it was. Had a guess. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why they have heaters in the tank on the trucks. They have, you know, heaters for the death fluid.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he stuck it in the shed, but it don't got, or in his barn, but he don't got no doors on it. And it was brutally cold for Oklahoma, and then we had more chaos yesterday. I missed it. We had more chaos yesterday with the ice storm, so which screwed things up apparently, but I had to go the long way round. I went up to Wichita Falls. I started in Dallas and went up to Wichita Falls and then up 44 into Oklahoma City. And by the time I got there, it had warmed up to like 36, 37 degrees. And I came along after the chaos, but everything froze at my house overnight. And icicles and all sorts of shit falling off the trees today. So, yeah. So, right, that's all I got. I'll let you get next, man. Okay, thanks.
That's all we need. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Wisconsin. Brad, welcome.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I've heard ether called as vitamins, but anyway, my pyrometer's still not working after I replaced the thermocouple. Guys, have any other ideas?
That could be the lead wire or the gauge itself. You know, all three components play a part in it. Generally, it is the thermocouple. There's two thin wires in there that if they get bumped, whether it's with someone working around it, someone hosing the engine off with a power washer, it can damage them and they quit working. But we actually have equipment here. We have a little box that we would take the thermocouple out of the picture, hook up some gator clips to it, and then as we turn our dial, our gauge will say 300 degrees, your gauge should say 300, ours says 6, and yours should say 6. If it's not correct, the next step is go to the head itself, the gauge itself, and do the same thing and see where the problem's at. If the gauge itself's reading correctly, then it's an indication it's the lead wire causing the problem. So they can be tested. Most people don't have the equipment, but we do.
Is there any way I can test it?
No, not without that piece of, not that I'm aware of, I should say that, not that I'm aware of. Like I said, it's a small box. It has a gauge on it that, you know, looks like a pyrometer. It's a needle that sweeps. And when I move it to 300, the gauge should read 300. When I move it to 600, it should say 600 and so forth. And you just keep going up. Because you can have a gauge read accurate at the low temperatures, but off at the high ends or vice versa. And they give you a range of what's acceptable.
Yep.
And this is a gauge or a tool that we got from Hewitt to test pyrometers and lead wires.
So if I sent my gauge in, you could take a look at it?
Test it, yeah. Mm-hmm. The lead wire and the gauge, we could test it.
So Hewitt, Hewitt is the company in Huntington Beach, California, that makes our pyrometers and our turbo boost gauges. We've been working with them for 48 years now.
Well, I was very happy with it up until it started acting up. It does a whole lot better than the old ISPRO.
Yes.
So I have a story to tell about ISPRO. At one time, we did use them, and we did a lot of Dodge pickups. The second generation Dodge, the mechanical engines, and you put a torque plate in, change the housing, and we generally knew the results we were going to get on a road test, pyrometer temp-wise and boost-wise. Well, all of a sudden, we're having pyrometer temp issues, like running way too hot. Nothing's making sense. Changing this, checking this. Turned out we checked the gauge, and they were reading incorrectly. So I called up ISPRO and said, hey, we got these gauges from you, and they're reading off. And they said, yeah, we know. We had a technician quit that sabotaged a bunch of the gauges. I said, okay, I'll send them back. And their response was, no, just tell your customers they're off by 100 degrees or 150 degrees, whatever it was. Like, absolutely not doing that. And we sent them all back, and that was the end of using those gauges.
All right, Pete. How did we end up getting those gauges? Because I wasn't familiar with that.
I don't know if we ran into an issue. This is when we were doing a lot of Dodge pickups, and we simply couldn't get enough of the Ute gauges. More than like, yeah. At one point, it looked like we had.
I'm surprised because I never did like that gauge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Would I need a return number? Or just get a hold of all the parts, guys.
You'd call us ahead of time. We'd give you a RMA number. That way, when it comes in, my guys will know what needs to be done with it.
All right, well, then I'll give you guys a call after the show here.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Charlie, welcome.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you guys today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Hey, about the refractometer. Leroy is correct. Except I thought you would know about it, Kevin, because that's what the military used to check antifreeze, but maybe the choppers didn't have antifreeze.
They did
when
not.
I worked for Pilot, okay, see? When I worked for Pilot, we actually had every truck that delivered to EF had to test the pump, the DEF in the ground before we dropped it. So if it was contaminated, we didn't drop it. And it was tested.
Okay.
And they look like little calculators. Like a Texas Instrument calculator, they're like $200-$300, and they just read out digitally the percentage of DEF. That's
how did you get it all the way down in the ground? Did you have a long probe?
No, Bruce. We just took it out the pump. We had a special card to take test samples. I was an employee pilot. We only did it at our locations. At Pilot Flying J locations.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else, it was their problem. But we'd actually test it, and it had to be between this and that. I don't remember the numbers, but it was supposed to be 32.5, and if it was within a range of this to that, it was good. It had a little lid on it, too. If you didn't shut the lid and the light, sun was hitting it, it wouldn't register it.
It's good knowledge.
Yeah, it's just, well, you can get them for anything, but they're like, I guess, $500 if you get the good ones and have a case with them. We just had them in the doors.
It's nice to know, though, that it's being tested.
Tested, yeah. At Brentag, they would blend it and test it before they loaded it, so we never had that fancy stuff. But at Pilot, they would blend it off the rail car and test it, the batches, and then we would test what was in the ground before we dropped it. So it was tested all the time that way. Like when we dropped at other places, though, like I said, we didn't test it. Because it was their tanks and it was their problem if it was contaminated. So if that helps you guys. So if you ever want to test it, you can buy a refractometer like the kind Leroy was mentioning. They're like 30, 40 bucks. I just looked online because I'm sitting here waiting for a, don't kill me, Kevin, but I'm waiting for shoulder replacement.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, so I don't want to hear about the medical thing because it's a torn rotator cuff and I need a reverse replacement because I'm so backwards, you know.
Yeah, well, that's no fun.
Yeah. Hey,
that's because you retired three times in your life and you keep coming back to work.
I know. Well, I'm going to park the truck till spring now, I guess. Did you find out about a rad for the spring, Pete?
I have not. So we're working with a new company. I haven't got any real numbers yet, but I am working on it.
Okay. All right. Just figured I'd check. But that's. You have any questions about the DEF? Oh, and it does freeze at like 10 or 12 degrees, but when it thaws out, it doesn't change it a bit.
Okay.
Because I asked that when it was introduced at the truck show in Louisville, when Brentag was going to start selling it and Daimler, Chrysler, Mercedes were the only ones, Detroit were the only ones going to use it. I asked, how do you keep it from freezing in trucks? And an engineer from Germany was there, and my boss called him over. He said, we don't have any problem with that. I said, well, heck, it was minus 10 up in upstate New York the other day. I mean, what? Oh, well, we had to rethink this. That's when they come up with the heaters. They didn't realize it was that damn cold over here. So that's why they put heaters in the trucks then after that. Not that it's my fault, but this was 2 years before they started it here. But, yeah. But it doesn't change it up in upstate New York. They just bring the totes inside if it froze. Like if they were sitting outside, they'd bring it inside and it would thaw out and it was fine. It gets cloudy and then it freezes into like a thick slush. Okay?
All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Will do. Let's go to Alberta. Dave, welcome.
Hey, if I have a question about exhaust temperature, like where would you want to see your pyro read downstream?
Ideally, ideally, you want the thermocouple to be in the exhaust manifold in front of number four cylinder, and that's the hot side. And 1,200-1,300 degrees is kind of the cutoff. If you go to 1,500 degrees occasionally, you're still okay. The steel top pistons will take it, but the cast iron exhaust manifold starts to suffer if you're running consistent high exhaust temps.
Okay, so I had this pyro put in about 2 years ago, just in front of the turbo, and this temperature read on a hard pull, it'll come up to 400 degrees, but normally it runs right around 300, and I'm just wondering about where you're expecting.
It's not working. Pyrometer's not working. Did we put it in?
No.
What brand of pyrometer is it?
It looks like it's got a W on it. I can't really make it out right now. It's got a circle with a W in it. I can't read it.
Yeah. The truck should idle at 300 degrees. Going down the highway on the level, you want to be at 800. You say you can hardly see 400.
Yeah, I got to stomp it pretty hard to get her to come up to 400. So this is in a Volvo V16 engine, and I had this pyro put in about 2 years ago because I had the emissions fixed at one time, and it had a digital readout of the pyrometer. But I lost that when it changed. I fixed the emissions. And it read the same. It read the same. And that pyrometer, I believe, was in the after treatment system. And it read the same value. Like, I mean, it was the highest I ever saw that thing read was 400, like 25.
Yeah, it can't be that low. So stop by our shop. Let's put a Hewitt in. You already have the whole. You said it was in the manifold in the hot side, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's put the Hewitt pyrometer in there, and then you'll have a good gauge.
Is it possible that it'll be running that low? Or is that just...
It can't. It can't run that low. It's impossible.
No.
You couldn't burn the fuel. You couldn't ignite it at those temperatures.
Yeah. All right, well, I've never been down to your part of the world, but I don't work down there, so I'll just find a local shop maybe to change that out. But what brand of gauge did you pick?
Order the Hewitt pyrometer from us. We'll ship it to you and have your mechanic put it in. Well, you could put it in. You already have the hole there. It's a quarter-inch pipe thread. And take that one out and put ours in. Put the thermocouple in, put some never sees on it. There's a red and yellow wire. You hook it up to the red and yellow wire on the lead wire. And then on the back of the gauge, it's just a push-on wire. You have a red and yellow. And just that's all it is. It's very simple to hook up. There's no 12 volts that goes to it or anything except for the light.
Yeah. Okay, I will do that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Illinois. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. So what about your ether? Have you ever run out of it? Brake cleaner is actually a diluted version of ether and pretty much works the same way.
Oh. I was wondering about that, and I'm glad you called and mentioned that, because I think I've used brake clean at times to start older engines years ago.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
Working on some snowmobiles and everything and don't want to hit it with the harsh ether to start it, I've used brake cleaner quite a bit. So.
Hey, are you coming to the owner-operator snowmobile conference on February 21st?
No, I am not this year.
Okay. Hey, speaking of things that will make fire, cheap hairspray, I think it was called Aquanet. If you spray it and you hold a match under it, boy, it'll put out a flame about 3 feet long.
Yeah, hairspray is also good for putting on, cheap hairspray is also good for putting the charger cooler boots on. Makes a sticky feeling so your boots actually stick to the thing before you put the band on them. Hey, Kevin.
Whenever you're putting the cheap hairspray, don't put the match to it.
No.
The hairspray inside the rubber boot.
Yep.
Slide it on the charger cooler and the piping and put your clamp on.
Right. Hey, Kevin, when I'm in the queue, you actually sound echoey like you're on the other side of the church.
Yeah, I've talked about this, and it is a technological mystery. I know what's happening, but it shouldn't be able to happen, and we haven't figured out any way to fix it on this current system. What's happening is when you're hearing me on the app, my voice is coming through my high-quality headset, and it sounds good. When you're hearing me on the phone system, for some reason, it's being picked up by the microphone on my laptop. And it shouldn't be. There's no reason. I couldn't make it do this if I tried to, and yet it keeps happening. So, yeah, when you hear me, if you're sitting in the queue listening, or when you come on and you're hearing me on the phone, a lot of times it sounds really
yeah.
echoey.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as long as you guys know what's happening, so it's
yeah.
I just figured I'd let...
We know it, and I've spent an awful lot of time. Like I said, if I wanted to make my audio work like this, I wouldn't be able to. There's no way to make it do this except it's doing it.
Yep. All right. Well, you guys have a good week, and I will listen to the show. So have a good day.
All right, thanks for the call. Speaking of which, though, we are I'm pretty excited about where we are with technology. We're finally making some pretty big improvements. Right now, we've been on Starlink. I got to say this. I'm going to say it again. Elon Musk impresses me more and more all the time. Starlink, you look at what this guy does. He's got, like, six different companies that do all kinds of crazy stuff that he runs. Then he went and bought Twitter, and he spends an awful lot of time on Twitter or X these days. And I will tell you that Starlink, hands down, is the best internet I've ever dealt with. And I have dealt with 100 different forms of internet over the last 20 years, moving around, doing my show from the road. I've had every cellular card you can have. I've had signal aggregators. I've had satellite. Nothing as far as internet has been as good as Starlink. Not just the experience. The experience is incredible. You go online, takes you all of about 3 minutes to open an account and have the stuff shipped to you. When you get it, you pull it out of the box, you connect everything together, and it works. No technological problems, nothing complicated, high-quality stuff. And then I expected my internet quality, speed, all of that stuff to be not as good as the fiber I have coming into the house, except it's way better. The internet signal itself is more stable. It's faster. The quality on my TV picture when I'm streaming is very noticeably better on the Starlink. It looks like I'm getting true 4K on my Starlink. And I can switch back to my fiber, and my TV now looks up like I'm back to 720 pixels. I am really, really impressed with it. So we now have three Starlink systems. I've got one I borrowed from Aaron. We have one here at the house that will also be the one that will go on my coach when I travel. And then we have one out on the farm. And I'm seriously thinking about replacing our fiber down at the warehouse with Starlink, just because it works so much better. But then we've got something else that I'm hoping to maybe get activated today. I've got a backup that I will plug my Starlink into. I will keep the home fiber, and I'll plug that into this box. And then I have two cellular cards, and there are two cellular modems. I have AT&T and Verizon. I actually have four internet signals coming into one box that aggregates them. If this thing works the way it's supposed to, I should never, ever have an internet drop again. That should not be an issue. We'll see, because it has to happen really, really fast in order not to lose any audio. But that should make things much better once I get that up and running. And we had another meeting yesterday about our software, finally replacing the phone system. And everything's on track. It's looking really good. We had a long meeting yesterday, worked out some things. We should be testing that by the end of the month. So hopefully audio quality, the technical issues we've had, hopefully we're about to overcome all of those. And once we get it done for me here, then we'll start building systems for our remote broadcasters like you guys that are at Pittsburgh Power. We'll make this a whole lot easier and better quality. So we're excited about that. Let me check the calls here. I need some calls screened. We've got Morgan, if you could screen the last three calls that are up there, and then don't take any more calls. I do have a big meeting at 11 o'clock about relaunching the CMC at Mass. We'll probably have meetings every day for a while to get that caught up. So we're going to take these last three calls that are on the board. We won't be taking any more calls. So if you're not on the board, don't dial. We're not going to take or screen those calls. Anybody have anything else? We've got a minute or so here while we're waiting to screen a call. What do we got?
I don't really have anything.
What?
You were just both. You started with him.
We did, I know. I know. He was snoozing again. All right, we're going to talk to Matt. Matt, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, everyone. Well, first, it's funny listening to you talk about cold weather, Kevin, and the harsh winter and all that, because you don't even get a harsh winter, even this year.
Well,
not compared to me.
That is correct, but I will tell you, like I said, I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio in the snow belt between Cleveland and Buffalo. I lived in Colorado at over 9,000 feet. I'm aware of what really harsh winters are like, and I got to tell you, this last storm that I just dealt with out here is, in my memory, the worst, the most work I've had to do, the most problems I've ever had based on weather. And part of it is because it was very extreme for us, and we don't prepare for this kind of stuff. Like, for heat out here, we have heat pumps. Heat pumps, once you get below 30, are almost worthless. When you get down to zero, they might as well be air conditioners. I mean, they just do not work at all at those temperatures. They don't put out any heat at all. And we don't insulate as well. We don't protect our pipes as well because we don't need to. And all you hear around here right now is burst pipes and water damage. This one sounds awful to me. I was talking to somebody who owned a small business, and they came into their building the other day with 2 feet of water in the building. The hot water heater is in the attic, and the pipe burst on it. Who thought of that? Why would you put a water heater in the attic?
Because in the summertime, that's the hottest part of the house, so that would probably be most efficient.
Oh, but man, come on, if you spring a leak, you just know you're going to ruin the whole building.
Yeah, there's a huge difference in, you know, building code and all that, because I get a kick out of down in Florida where they got PVC water pipes just running across the yard on top of the ground.
Right.
So all I can think about is, boy, that would suck in a cold weather event.
Well, so I do have a burst pipe to deal with, and it's exactly that. In the pump house, they ran PVC pipe, and about 2 feet of it is actually laying on the concrete. And that's where it burst and where it froze and burst.
So
I'm going to repair that. I'm going to get that about 6 to 8 inches off the ground.
Last Friday, Jerry, regular caller, had asked about how cold people will not idle their truck. Now, considering you got a bunk heater to keep yourself warm and either an aqua heater to heat the engine or Tri-Pak or the other brands, whatever, APU, that heats the engine block. Joel is obviously very extreme because he said he was 43 below once and didn't idle his truck.
Yeah.
Me personally, it all depends on the truck. You know, newer engines and lower viscosity oils start crank easier. For me, it's 10 below is my number just because, A, I run north and south, so I don't even sleep in Minnesota in the truck that common in the cold weather. And, you know, at home I'll shut it off and not worry about it. It's plugged in. But
to me, it's just, yeah, if I'm on the road and if anything went wrong, you know, I'm trying to deal with it in a parking lot or at a customer or something, I'd rather just idle if it gets down to 10 below.
It seems a whole lot to me. Unless, like you say, you got a new modern truck and you know that it starts that cold. And some of these things do. They're pretty incredible.
Yep. And yeah, so far this season I've idled one night. And, okay. You know, we're really only 4 or 5 weeks away from, you know, the worst of the cold being over. So, and I can tell you that in the 10-day forecast, they don't have to worry about it because we're getting rain in Minnesota and the 2 inches of snow we did have is going to be gone this week.
Yeah, we've been getting rain for about 36 hours now, just this light drizzle coming out of the sky, and it's nowhere near enough to get rid of the 2 feet of snow we still have on the ground. It's just kind of still really messy here. But we may be up into the 50s in the next couple of days.
Yep. And, yeah, the propane engine thing, I always assumed, like you did, Kevin, that, gosh, a propane engine with spark plugs, that should fire real easy in cold weather. Should run no problem. But I can't explain why. I don't know the reason. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they're – a propane internal combustion engine is horrible in cold weather. They just will not fire.
My thought was I guess I was just trying to use logic that – doesn't necessarily work, that it seems like the heavier the fuel, the harder it is to start that engine in the wintertime. So we switch from number two to number one, and kerosene, they're lighter fuels, they start easier. And in my mind, about the lightest fuel we use is propane. It's a really light, like you say, it's a spark plug. In my mind, I'm thinking if everything else is starting, if my old mechanical diesel is starting, the propane should fire right up. And I went out there and cranked and cranked and cranked, and that thing would just not go. And I thought, and even in my mind, I'm like, do you use ether on propane? And I'm thinking, why not? I mean, it's an internal combustion engine. It should work just fine. And sure enough, a tiny little shot. Again, it's not like I soaked the air cleaner, tiny little shot in there, and that's all it needed to get it going. And once it was going, it ran pretty smooth. But I was shocked. I could not get it started without it.
No. Yeah, because, you know, Dale Howard, he's always got a funny one-liner for everything. And, of course, you know, him living in Alberta where 30 and 40 below in the winter, it's, you know, fairly common.
Normal. Yeah.
A couple of times throughout the winter. He says, yeah, a propane engine, if you're eating an ice cream cone in front of that engine, it probably won't start.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised. I really, like you, I thought the opposite. I thought that should be the one engine I don't have to worry about.
Yeah. So the DEF, we have a 2016 Jeep Grand Cherokee with a 3-liter diesel. And like Leroy was explaining with his Volkswagen, we get, I think, around 1,200 miles to the gallon on DEF. But our Jeep has a 12-gallon tank. It's very large for a small vehicle. So it's once a year we're putting DEF in it.
You're saying the DEF tank is 12 gallon?
I think so. Because on average, you know, it gives a light, a warning when you get to 25%. And at that point, we're putting like 8 gallons in.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, we only buy it in bulk. We got a store right in town, truck stop, that has bulk at the pump. So, we just every 9-10 months or so, top it off and never worry about it.
Wow.
There you go. So I think their date on when it goes bad is probably not like a hard date that, you know, maybe you lose a little bit of quality, but not enough to make any difference.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that Jeep is parked in a garage. I mean, it's insulated, but it's not air conditioned in the summer, but I don't know.
Yeah, so it can get pretty hot in there.
But
But then again, I think the tank on the vehicle is more sealed, so like the condensation side of it, or evaporation side, I should say, I think in the vehicle is probably way less than any type of storage container.
Could be. I haven't heard of many problems with the EF quality, so.
The only engine I own that has it, so I don't have a whole lot of experience. But I was wondering, like, on the bulk side now, if you did, because obviously just one vehicle or a 2.5-gallon jug, you just throw it away if it's bad. But if you had a bulk tank and it has evaporated some of the water out, could you add distilled water to bring the percentage of urea back down?
You know, I've got a fuel guy that I interact with on X. Maybe I'll run these questions by him. He would probably know all of this.
No.
Let me do that.
All righty. Well, I'll let you wrap up the rest of the call so you can get on with your meetings today.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to California. Harold, welcome.
Gentlemen, I have a question. In this 2020 Peterbilt with an X15, I ordered all the gauges I could, and it came without a pyrometer. They just don't put them in here anymore. But I put the OTR scan gauge in here. I bought a subscription for that. So I can see my diesel particulate filter temperature, and I'm wondering if you know what the difference is in what would be a pyrometer reading and the diesel particulate filter temperature. I can get it up to around 700 going up a hill, and I'm thinking it's maybe 300 degrees difference. Any ideas on that?
I mean, DPF temperature is kind of vague. Is it DPF inlet temp or is it DPF outlet temp?
That I don't know. It's just whatever shows up on the scan gauge. But when I'm climbing the hill, about the most it'll get is 700 degrees. Right now I'm kind of in some rollers, and it's running about 565 right now. I didn't know if you'd ever tested it or looked at that on your dyno or not.
I know sometimes some trucks use the DOC inlet temperature as the pyrometer gauge, which doesn't really make much sense because it's like 3 feet away from the back of the turbo. And that temperature sounds about right for under full load, about like 700 degrees there. That would be what my guess would be.
So I'd probably be somewhere around 900 to 1,000 if the pyrometer was in the right place?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the only way I know for sure is actually put an actual pole there.
Yeah, it's irritating. They just won't put them in these trucks anymore from the factory. And this is, I mean, I've had many trucks over the years. This is the first one without one. So, all right. Well I thought I'd check and see if you had any numbers on from the dyno that you had there.
Yeah.
Is this Harold, the car hauler?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Bruce?
Good.
we're the same age now for a few months. So.
Okay. And we're still working.
I can't not work. I go crazy without it. I just love it.
I can tell you, down here in Florida in a retirement community, these people that have nothing to do, they do not like it.
After two or three days at home, I'm ready to go again, and my dog's ready to go with me. So she gets nervous if we're there very long.
I was talking to a guy this morning, has a little dog in his golf cart. He said, she lets me know every morning when it's time to go in the golf cart for the ride. And then I think of all the dogs that are riding in semi-trucks that are the same way. This full retirement. I said I was going to work till I was 76, so that's a year and 3 weeks. I probably won't quit at 76.
I'm hoping I can go until I'm 80, but we'll see.
Now, don't you have some type of auxiliary heater? Don't you have an APU on this truck?
No, I had that polar storm unit for the air conditioner and for the hydraulic when I first brought it in to you, but that failed miserably, and I ended up putting the electric APU on just for my air conditioning and for my hydraulic pump. So I'm running that on a 24-volt system. The guy up there by Chicago put that in. But I don't – all I have is an SFAR heater, which I like sleeping cold, so I rarely use it. I did idle mine the other day in Toledo. It was 5 degrees, and I started the truck up about 1 o'clock and let it run because I was worried more about the truck than myself. I didn't want the airlines or the fuel to freeze up. And even with the house in there, I started freezing. My fuel lines felt like they were freezing up on the – and it was like a clogged artery where just a little bit of fuel was getting through. On my way into Chicago that day, it was 4 degrees, and I don't know what the wind chill was, but I added some more. I had some of the Lucas, the stuff for the anti-gel, and I put a little bit more of that in there when I was loading the car, and it took an hour just to raise that back deck up because the hydraulic fluid just did not want to move. So,
Pete, what do we call our anti-gel?
Cold Snap.
Cold Snap. Have you tried our Cold Snap?
I have not. I've been using your Catalyst forever, and I didn't know if they sent me the winter stuff this time or not, but it's almost time for that to be over. So I rarely add anything, but as cold as it was, I ended up putting some of that house in there.
Because the chemist who makes the Cold Snap for us, I've known him for 40-some years, and he was the chemist that started FPPF. And Jackie Warmly uses FPPF. Well, this fellow's name was Glenn, and he started that company, and he was supposed to – the guy that funded it for him was an accountant. And after so many years, Glenn had the option to buy it. And then things were going well, and the accountant backed out of the deal, so Glenn started his own. And that's when I really became friends with him. And so when it came time to have the Cold Snap made, we went to him, and he formulated it for us and bottles it. And so it's been a product that's been around a long time, even though it's – we're new to marketing it. It's a 40-some-year-old product.
Okay.
It works very, very well.
Okay, good. I'll pick some of that up next time I'm there for next winter then.
So you think winter's going to be over already, mid-January?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I make about a trip back and forth between California and Boston every 3.5 weeks, so I usually get 3 trips that are pretty cold, so I don't know. By March it'll be warming up again, I imagine. But this trip I went on was probably one of the coldest trips I've done in 49 years overall. You know, I started in a blizzard in Vermont and then ended up in Chicago there at 4 degrees, and I just hadn't seen that bad of weather in the last 20 years or so. Maybe when I first started, I saw some really cold stuff up in Wyoming, which I don't go through there anymore in the wintertime. But it was chilly. You were in the right place during all this freezing temperatures, Bruce.
Well, it wasn't really nice down here. It was rainy and windy and cold. We had some 53-degree morning. Colder than 53. I mean, people are really bundled up down here. But we have an owner-operator, a retired owner-operator, living in a sailboat, and he's working at the marina, and he pumps gasoline and diesel fuel. And he said, man, did I get bored really quick with retirement. And I talked to a lot of the guys, the retired guys that are working at Home Depot. They
The one girl told me they start you out at $17.50 an hour, and they say it's not the money, it's the fact that they need something to do with their time.
So, I understand that completely. I need the carrot and the stick in my life.
That's right.
The carrot and the stick for me. I got to have something to get up.
Need a reason to get up in the morning.
Exactly. I think that's a lost item in this society nowadays. But I don't know. I took 2 years off after I sold a business when I was 48 years old, and I went crazy until I stumbled into car hauling, and it's been good for me at this age. Keeps me stretching and moving and doing things and thinking about it all the time, because we do private vehicles. I think you know that, and we have like 250 customers a year that are our own customers. Most of them are, so it's good dealing with them a little bit on the pickup side and on the delivery side, and keeps me thinking and moving.
There you go. My operator.
My wife sent me up on the library app, I think, in November, and I've listened to 35 full-length novels, mostly the Harry Bosch series and The Lincoln Lawyer, in the last 2 months. 35 full-length novels when I'm not listening to Kevin and you guys listening to books.
There was a owner-operator. He was 62 or 64. He said, honey, been on the road for 35 or 40 years, married to the same woman, and it's either I'm going to retire or have Bruce build me a truck. She said, you better have Bruce build you a truck.
Yeah.
So a man that was never home, and now all of a sudden he's home and wants three meals a day, and he could bring on a divorce.
Yes.
So,
I would. My situation, I've been married 41 years now, and bless her heart, she's, but when I'm home, it sometimes does get difficult.
Yeah. It's interesting how people that work for large companies count the days till they're 62 and they can retire. God, 62 in our industry is just another year.
Yeah, you're not kidding. All right. Hey, we had to move along. I've got to knock out these last two calls. Let's get to Wisconsin. Mick, welcome.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, one thing that I was thinking about with your propane, you might try if it's not too much hassle, put the tank inside. I think the propane has trouble going through the regulator when it's cold, I think is a lot of the issue on that.
It's interesting. My tank is buried, so it should be warmer. That's a big tank, 1,000 gallons, so it's pretty well buried. It's deep. It's a big tank. Somebody explained to me why this happens on propane, and it made total sense. And I just saw a video the other day. It was so cold out that the guy was standing outside with a wine glass, and it looked like he had white wine in it, and he was swirling it. It was propane. Propane liquefies when you get it super cold.
Sure.
So as a gas.
Yeah, because it just, it pulls the gas off the top. Yeah.
Yeah, so as a gas, it flows through all the lines and the regulators. The cold, doesn't affect it until it does. So it is a nice light fuel until it gets cold enough to liquefy, and then you're right. We're going to have a hard time moving it through lines and regulators. It's not going to ignite. That makes sense to me.
Okay, yeah. I don't advocate this, but I've got one of those little propane-fired heaters that you – anyway, when it's really cold out, if you just move the tank a little closer to in front of the heater, it makes it work a lot better. But
well,
you don't want to get it too close, obviously. But
one of the things I do, I fill those throwaway 1 pound bottles. I fill those from my 20 pound. Yeah, I've got an adapter, and then what I do to make it work really well is I will set the 20-pound bottle outside in the sun and let it get nice and hot even, then I'll take the 1 pound bottles and put them in the freezer. And then I turn, then I seem to get a better fill. My 1 pound bottle weighs more than if I don't do that.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you're kind of forcing the 20-pound bottle to expand and, you know, getting the 1 pound bottle nice and chilled to kind of suck it in seems to work.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good, cool. Good tip. Hey, Bruce, what's the temperature difference on the pyrometer between the manifold and then the, like, I've got the Peterbilt. I think it's probably about 4 inches away from the turbo on the elbow.
It's 300 degrees.
300. So I've got a 99 2WS cat, and it's sitting here on the level, like right around just under 700 degrees. So that pretty good then, do you think, or is that running on the hotter side? Or
so you're on the level right now, correct?
Correct, yeah.
How many pound of turbo boost?
About 6 pounds right now.
Yeah, you're perfect. Absolutely perfect. The 800
right,
that we talk about is when you're on the hot side. So and that 300 degrees difference is when you're like at 1200 on the hot side is 900 on the cold. So
okay.
Now you're perfect right there. You're probably 800, 850 degrees. You don't get efficiency until you get to 800, so you're there.
All right, great. Yeah, it seems like it runs, you know, well, but
are you
in
a 379?
Yeah, it is. It's an 03 379. Originally it had a C12 in it, and that engine it actually still ran pretty good, but it was using oil and it had over a million miles. And I had never had a big engine before. And so I found this 2WS that a guy had, and I had it completely tore down and took the block to the machine shop and had it all made back to right. We reused the crank and the cam I have your manifold. I have the BorgWarner turbo. The 40s is the last numbers of the part. I think it's a 78-132, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
That's
a great turbo if you run easy, like you are right now. If you're going to run hard, then we want to go a little bit. We want to go up one size on turbine housing, one size on the wheel. But for running easy, that's perfect.
Okay. So I run around 63. It's still got the 370 gears from with the C12. I've got a full cutoff with the 264s in it. That's going to be one of my next projects.
Awesome.
So,
you'll be,
all right. Well, good.
You'll be shocked
to know
at the
them.
Difference in how it runs with those 264s. So.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited and. So, and then my temperature cutoff, I'm a little bit more theory than everybody else. If it's going to be below 10, I don't like to shut it off. But I have started it below zero, but I just kind of like what Matt said. If you're out on the road, your truck will not start when it's below zero, it is an all-day project to get it. And that's just horrible. I'd rather spend 30, 40
terrible.
Bucks of fuel. So that's just me.
No,
one other thing that I called a few weeks ago about the temperature on the transmission. And so I took that, I bypassed or unhooked that oil cooler and just put about a 4 foot loop hose up inside the rail. And it sits there, runs around right at 125 to 130 now, whereas before it would barely creep up over 100. So, but that's, you know, 30 degree temperature.
Good.
So,
yeah, that's good.
Well, all right, that's all I got, guys.
Get back when you put the 264s in and then tell us your temperature and your transmission is going to go down again when you're running indirect.
Yeah, okay. All right, thanks.
Good.
Good stuff. Thanks for the call. We are going to take the final call of the day. Justin, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I sent you an oil sample there.
Well, this one's pretty easy. Do you have any concerns?
No, just that base, I guess, was yellow, and otherwise, yeah, I think it looked good. I don't have a bypass or none of that extra stuff, just 15,000 miles on that oil, so I think I'm going to keep it, go a little longer with it, I guess.
Oh, I absolutely would. There's no reason not to go longer on this oil. That's why we sample. The oil itself is in great condition. You're getting close on the base. Yeah, if we get under two, then I'm going to start adding. So I would just grab some base additive and dump some of that in.
I think I'm going to have to add one more gallon here pretty soon. Will that add a little base too, or will I still need to add the...
No,
okay.
If you're going to add a gallon, I wouldn't even bother putting base additive in yet.
Okay. Well, that sounds real good then.
Yeah, this looks really good for an Acer especially.
Okay. Oh, that's all I kind of had there other than just to tell Bruce, I used to work on snowmobiles. We spent time in Grand Lake and Granby, Colorado there getting our sleds ready for X Games and stuff. And one of these years I want to make it out to his conference, but it won't be this year. So.
Well, we're going to be in Grand Lake.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing. That's where you guys are at. So we spent a few.
Where do you live?
I live in North Dakota, but I work for a snowcross team out of Minnesota. There we raced snowcross sleds, and we'd go to X Games, but we'd take a week or two ahead of time to go get acclimated, get the guys acclimated and the sleds ready and the elevation and stuff before the X Games.
Were
there.
You at the X Games in 2003?
I started in either 2003 or 2004, so.
2003, I was representing the new Skidoo, the Reb chassis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was maybe 1 year before I started. The first team I worked for was actually out of St. Cloud, and they raced Skidoos. That was my first year I helped them. But, that probably was 04, 05.
Bombardier wanted me to send them a bill for my time. I had so much fun out there, I didn't even bother.
Yeah,
I just really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. Buttermilk, Colorado. Great, it's a great ski mountain, by the way, too.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't get much time for any extra stuff other than working, and those games you put a lot of time in for a 15-minute race on TV, but if you could come out on top, it was a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
But.
Well, you should come. We'll make you one of the speakers at the conference.
I don't know about that. I've been out of it for 10 years now, but.
Okay. You know, I just bought a new 850 Skidoo Turbo, and my God, do I love that machine.
Yeah, they've come a long ways. I know that.
No, it's balanced so well. You just counter-steer, flip the throttle, and put your weight on. If you want to go to the left, put your weight on your left leg, and it just lays right over and pulls around. It's a wonderful machine.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty amazing.
And then out of Portland, Oregon, I just bought a set of or a pair of heated goggles that heat the frame now.
Oh.
And let me tell you, for people that might need heated goggles, they're wonderful because they don't fog. It's Tempest, T-E-M-P-E-S-T.
Okay.
And I'll tell you where they're out of. Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
Look at that.
The old heated goggles we had a heating pack on the side, and if you didn't keep them charged, then it went dead. And so I'm going to call them now and order a new heating pack. But I heard about Tempest through Mike Lane, and I called them, and they sent me a pair. I just got them yesterday. And, in Florida, I don't really need them, but I'll use them when I get back to Colorado in about 3 weeks, and looking forward to it. The heating element is right in the frame of the lens. And here's the other beautiful thing.
the lens is held on with magnets.
Oh, those are nice.
So you just pop it off, and you just flip it back on the new one when you want to change colors. There's nothing. You don't have to get it down in that groove and get the fingerprints all over the lens.
Yeah, that's nice.
Very interesting.
And then there's one other thing I'm going to leave you with, Kevin. Angie talked me into two more bags of monkey brittle when I was ordering my, what's the stuff you put, do you take for your gut?
Probiotics.
Oh, boy, does your probiotic work well?
Yes, it does.
Gut's acting up. That stuff really works. So I got the monkey brittle and the other day. By 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm looking for something sweet, and I took some monkey brittle and I put extra rich whipped cream on it.
Wow. There you go.
That good.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Good stuff. All right.
Okay.
We are going to wrap this up, and we'll do it again next week. Thanks to the team from Pittsburgh Power. As always, if you have any other questions between now and then, give them a call. We will see you back here tomorrow for Destination Health. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey.